Now, I have no idea. I was looking at the sponsoring groups. I was figuring, well, it'll be a bunch of Congregationalists, UCC people, and Unitarians. But that's probably not the case, right?
Right.
It's probably far more than that. Right. Are there any UCCs people here? Well, a few, okay. And any Unitarians here?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, some of you will understand some of the of the history here. cultural despisers of religion? No?
We haven't.
That's a very honorable thing, you know. Most of the Enlightenment, all those Enlightenment philosophers were cultural despisers of religion. Thomas Jefferson and others. Well, now, where to start? The usual place I figure we have to start is that we have this pretense in this country of the separation of church and state, the separation of politics and religion, politics, economics, and religion. And I hope that we're beginning to see that to a degree this is a pretense. And in fact, it's not the case. That is, not only do we have the civil rights movement coming heavily out of the black church and then making politics, and then we realize that some of those spirituals that seemed to be otherworldly weren't at all, because they quickly would translate back into political implications. But then with the rise of the Christian right and the last two elections, we can see that there's a large group of very, very religious people in this country whose politics are as conservative, as much to the right, as is their religion. Now, I'm already giving away my orientation here. So, and I want to be careful to say that there is no truth that anybody has monopoly on. I guess that's one of the arguments with the Christian right, is that they think they have a monopoly on religious truth. There's no truth that anybody has a monopoly on. And I'm speaking out of a very small minority of biblical scholars. I'm one of a very small minority that tries to argue that there ain't no separation of politics and religion and economics historically. That's a peculiar modern Western separation. And if we hadn't seen that before, don't we see it now in what's happening in the Middle East? The movements, the anti-Western imperial movements, are grounded in a traditional Abrahamic faith that does not make that separation. And it's been the West that's been trying to impose that separation and trying to reduce religion to something private and separate from politics and economics, as it is in the Western tradition. Now, let's pick that up and quickly move into American history, American tradition, where also there was not that separation of politics and religion. All right, in the university even, when we're dealing with religion and the religion departments, we have to be very careful, especially in a state university, that nothing we do has implications politically or economically. So we call it the study of religion. We're not theological. I'm not a theologian. We call this the study of religion. Nevertheless, the Bible and Jesus are not just religious figures. So let's just go back a couple centuries. The founding fathers and mothers understood that there was no separation. And let's just use a couple examples. I want to come back to these. In New England, we're familiar with this. Boston, Plymouth, and many other towns were originally covenant communities founded by Puritans who, when they came to the U.S., understood themselves as taking a new Exodus from a new Egypt and a new Pharaoh, and the new Pharaoh and the new Egypt were England, and the Exodus was the trip across the Atlantic. And when they got to the Promised Land, they founded new covenant communities. And not only did they understand the Mosaic Covenant, the Ten Commandments, as political, as a political charter, they understood Jesus' Sermon on the Mount as a political charter. They were naive enough, of course, to think that everybody could love everybody, right, in these new small covenanted communities. It wasn't just the church that was a covenant community. It was the whole community that was a covenanted community. And there's not much difference in whether it's a congregational church or a village meeting house. They had the same function. Now, let's go one more step here. 1775 and all that. In New England especially, but spreading further, the Revolutionary War was understood as a new Exodus. and the Constitution was understood explicitly as a new covenant. And people speaking in favor of the ratification of the Constitution made an argument something like this: as the 12 tribes of Israel, you know, centuries ago, created a new model of civil government on Mount Sinai, so now the 13 states are creating a new model of civil government here in the Constitution. Not only, of course, was it a model of civil government, but it was also a beacon, a historical beacon to other peoples that other peoples could copy and see here a community founded on justice in action. Now, the reason I want to pick up on this is because this is where Jesus starts, and that covenant and that exodus were exodus away from empire and were an attempt to establish an alternative society, an alternative to empire. By the way, let's just throw in a couple more little tidbits here. That deist, Thomas Jefferson, and that, what should we call Benjamin Franklin? I'm not sure what we call Benjamin Franklin. Sitting down to design the Great Seal of the United States. You know what they wanted to make the Great Seal of the United States? Picture of Moses leading the Israelites through the Red Sea. Can you imagine that as the Great Seal of the United States? But that was their sense. So it wasn't just New England preachers. It was also Jefferson, Franklin, and others of those founding fathers and mothers. Now, let me now jump to biblical history. And with those two examples of how we can come back around and tie the United States back into this, and how the example of the historical Jesus may have some implication for what's happening in the United States today, let's back up and talk Exodus and Covenant, because that's where I think we need to understand the background of Jesus. This is revisionist history on my part, but I think that's where we have to go with it. The Exodus from Egypt, from hard bondage of people who somehow knew they didn't belong there, and finally managed to make the exodus, make the escape, a little stimulation from on high. Then once they were out of Egypt, away from the bondage, they made a covenant with God, who they understood to be their liberator from hard bondage, from subjection to Pharaoh, from hard labor. And let's focus a bit on the structure and the implications of that covenant. Israel on Sinai is asked, spoken to by God, and basically there are three steps here. It isn't just the Ten Commandments. It isn't just those ten principles. There's a prologue. There's a preface. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. God is the liberator who's speaking. Second part, God says, now here's some principles, and we think of them Ten Commandments, morality, and so forth. Let me suggest these are principles of social policy. Can I use that term? Principles of social policy that the new society is supposed to follow here. The first four pertain to exclusive loyalty to God, their liberator, and the next six pertain to political economics within the covenanted community. And notice how political economics those are. Ever think about this? Thou shalt not kill, of course. Thou shalt not covet or steal, economic. Bear false witness, economic. Father and mother, honor father and mother. Well, familial, yes, but in Jesus' interpretation at least, feed the elderly. Feed Ma and Pa, economic. Very much economic as well as political rights here. Who is God according to this covenant? God is the king of the society, who then dictates the social policy in these principles. And let me just toss out one more suggestion about these. Think about what is being protected by these prohibitions. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not covet and steal. Thomas Jefferson said, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. John Locke, the Scottish philosopher, also a Calvinist, said, life, liberty, property. Life, liberty, property. Right. These are principles of social policy that are to be observed under the kingship of God. And if God is the king, the literal king of the society, there can be no more pharaohs, no more human kings, no more human emperors. That follow logically there? Okay. Now, there's a third step in this covenant, and that is sanctions on this. This kind of covenant was a system of government, but it's not monarchy. It is theocracy, but it isn't just theocracy, in the sense that there's no government except the kingship of God. It's anarchy. Yeah, it's anarchy. How's it going to work? Well, it can only work if there's this exclusive loyalty to the king, to the divine king, and if people then maintain that covenant relationship. And the way that's going to work is periodic meetings together to renew the covenant. There's a matter of calling witnesses, and in this case, the people witness against themselves, the beginnings of what we know of as conscience, and then blessings and curses. They'd call down blessings on themselves if they would keep the covenant, and curses if they did not. So those three steps. There's the story of liberation, the new principles of social policy for a different kind of society, and the blessings and curses as a way of enforcing this. And a system that is theocracy and anarchy. Yeah, theocracy and anarchy. Sort of democracy too, but keep in mind that there is no human government here. Not only no king, but no human government. And this was a covenantal system that worked for 200 years in early Israel before the Philistines came along and before they needed to have centralized military leadership under Saul and so forth to hold their own against the Philistines. And then, of course, they compromised it. Then, of course, they went for a kingship, and the kingship became an imperial kingship, and so forth. Now I want to jump, fast forward to the time of Jesus, and then ask ourselves to continue in the vein of not separating religion and politics and understanding the circumstances of Jesus. And obviously, the place we have to start is with the Roman Empire. Jesus is crucified. What's crucifixion? It's a method, it's a means of execution used by the Romans for two kinds of people. Slaves, disruptive slaves, disobedient slaves, and cantankerous provincials, people who make trouble. And of course, Jesus, the inscription on the cross is Jesus of Nazareth, rebel king of the Judeans. Jesus of Nazareth, rebel king of the Judeans. He's crucified because he's a rebel leader against the Roman imperial order. Let me start with just a few factors about Roman imperialism and the Roman imperial order. Then let's talk about the general Judean resistance to this. And then let's finally zero in on Jesus. And obviously we can't cover too much ground, but we'll just be selective in taking a few salient points from the mission of Jesus. Jefferson and Franklin and company thought that they were imitating the Roman Republic. And it was very important to model themselves on what they thought of as republican virtue of Julius Caesar and company. Trouble was, what Jefferson didn't notice, didn't take account of, what it was the Roman Republic that built an empire. And think about the aspects of that Roman Republic. The Romans thought of themselves as a superior people with a mission to take over other peoples. And so they gradually took over the peninsula of Italy, and then they were at war with Carthage, but found an excuse to destroy Carthage, found an excuse to destroy other cities like Corinth, where Paul had a mission at one point, and just steadily, relentlessly took over the rest of the Mediterranean world. Secondly, the Romans, when they conquered territory, were absolutely brutal in the conquest, and especially if they had to come in and conquer it again. They were brutal, and even more brutal in reconquest. They would come into an area like Judea or Galilee, where Jesus was, where his career was located, and they would kill first and ask questions later. They would destroy villages. They would either enslave people or allow them to stay, but then in with the appropriate intimidation. And then let's just focus in on this just a bit because this is so important for Jesus. They would crucify the ones who resisted in some sort of prolonged way. They'd hunt them down, nail them up on crosses or attach them to crosses. And what all of this amounted to was, wouldn't you say, the terrorization of the populace. The terrorization of the populace. And they consciously did this. This is a way of intimidating the people they conquered. Then they then wouldn't have to maintain standing armies in the conquered territories. They could simply intimidate the people by the brutality. And the crucifixion, of course, is the symbol of this, you know, among subject peoples. Now, then to maintain the imperial order, they wouldn't just keep standing armies. Rarely would they keep standing armies. And the areas that needed civilizing still generally required local rulers who would understand the local populace a bit better and would be ruthless in their local rule. Enter people like Herod the Great. The Romans appointed Herod to be king of the Judeans. He wasn't even really a Judean. He was sort of half Judean. And Herod then ruled ruthlessly to sort of maintain order. And he, as a Roman client, then taxed the people intensely. And then he was the model of a Roman client ruler, a model of development, a model of managing building projects that included temples in honor of Caesar later on when there was an emperor, and projects that included rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem in grand Roman Hellenistic style. Isn't that an interesting one? That wouldn't have been recognizable any longer to local Judeans because it was rebuilt in grand style, three, four times larger than it ever had been, and became one of the wonders of the ancient world. Client rulers, Herod. Let's add into this that the Romans and then Herod as their client ruler maintained the high priests in power, the high priests in the temple. Now, here's another adjustment we have to make. The temple wasn't just a religious institution. Of course it was also religious. It was the place where sacrifices were offered to the God of the Judeans, the God of Israel. But the temple was a political economic institution as well. It's the center of the economy, in a centralized tributary economy, where the goods flowing in the sacrifices and the tithes for the priests flowed into the temple from the peasant villages. By the way, the temple hierarchy would be a tiny little fragment of the population, 1% or 2%. Working for them would have been the scribes and Pharisees. They weren't artisans and they weren't a middle class. They would have been people representing the temple, working for them, running the system. And then 90% of the populace would be the people in the villages who raised the crops and paid the tithes and offerings. This is a standard system in the ancient Near East, and the Romans just maintained it. They kept the temple hierarchy, the high priests, in power, so that the local representative of the Roman imperial order would have been Herod and other Herodian kings and the high priests, the temple. Now, sorry if I'm stepping on any toes here, you know, a traditional Jewish understanding of the temple, but in fact, the temple was a subset of the imperial order. It was that way since the Persians founded it back in the 6th century, and that's exactly what the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and so forth say. That's exactly what the biblical literature says it was. Now, this in no way suggests that the Jews generally were a subset of empire. Just the contrary, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But I want to make sure that we understand that the way the Roman imperial system worked was through client rulers in Palestine. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that the Romans also created a lot of infrastructure, bridges and canals and roadways.
Yeah.
So they benefited the populace that way, at least. They weren't that brutal to that extent.
Yeah. Everybody hear the question? The Romans created a lot of infrastructure, including roads and so forth. This, by the way, is a standard view in biblical studies and as well as in Roman history. Now, just a couple of qualifications here. In this case, it would be the Roman client rulers who did that, like Herod, rebuilding the temple and so forth. So in that extent, we'd say, yes, the heavy taxation was also then benefiting the people insofar as there was a fancy new temple there. As for Roman roads, anybody have a sense of how those Roman, what those Roman roads were used for?
Army.
Military. Move the military around quickly, and then the trade. And who did trade benefit?
Rome.
Romans and the indigenous elite. They're the only people who could afford luxury products. So the yes, it benefited the indigenous people, but it had benefited the client rulers of the indigenous people. And this is something we're only, I think, in the last generation beginning to sort of get clear that we need to carry on what Mel Lyman and I were earlier discussing as a kind of class analysis, that we need to keep the social structure in mind, this tiny elite at the top in cahoots with the Roman elite, their representatives, scribes, Pharisees, so forth, and then the vast majority of the people who would live in peasant villages and would be raising the crops and paying taxes, tithes, and tribute. Well, while thinking of taxes, tithes, and tribute, let's add one more dimension here. For the people, the implications are what had been a system with tithes and offerings to the temple suddenly had the Romans taking tribute, and they put Herod in charge, and Herod was taking taxation. Taxes suddenly tripled, right? I mean, functionally, structurally. The pressure on the peasantry who were raising the crops in an agrarian society intensified. Now, looking at the clock, I need to move along in order to make sure we at least give equal time to Jesus here. But moving that direction, we need to go another step. Jesus was not the only king of the Judeans around. He was probably in his day a minor figure compared to other prophets and kings of the Judeans, Galileans, and so forth. And let's talk about them just a bit. The Judeans just couldn't get it straight, Judeans and Galileans and other Israelites, couldn't get it straight that they were under the domination of a very, very superior power. They kept rebelling. They kept insisting that they wanted to live in their traditional way of life. And they were unusual in the ancient Roman times for this continuing rebellion. And let's just talk about this broadly and then bring it down to some distinctive movements here. Broadly speaking, the mission of Jesus is framed by massive popular rebellions. Not only is there the Maccabean Revolt, now some of you know about that. That's celebrated by Hanukkah, and especially in the United States, it's celebrated by Hanukkah. That's a revolt against the Roman predecessors. The Antiochus Epiphanes, a Seleucid ruler, a Western ruler, but a Greek-speaking Seleucid ruler. Then, when Herod took over, it took him 3 years to conquer his own people, especially in Galilee. There continued resistance in Galilee. So that's 40 to 37 before BCE, before the Common Era. When Herod died, there's massive rebellion all around his realm, in Galilee, in the Transjordan, and in Judea. Massive popular rebellions. Herod's dead. We can now finally have our independence. 30 years after Jesus' mission, there's another massive rebellion, the Great Jewish Revolt, the Great Jewish Rebellion against the Romans. And 70 years later, there's another massive Judean rebellion against the Romans. They just wouldn't give up. And think about how that's rooted. That's rooted in their sense that God is their true, legitimate ruler, their true king, and they can't have another king. Now, that's carried on mostly by common people. There were intellectuals, the scribes, Pharisees, and they're kind of caught in the middle. They're the ones helping run the system for Herod and the high priests, and then indirectly the Romans. But they're the ones who cultivated this tradition, this covenantal tradition, that God is our true king. So every so often, some of the radicals among those scribes and Pharisees got a little bit cantankerous and would protest what's going on. So a group would cut down the giant golden Roman eagle above the gate of the temple. And then, of course, the teachers and the students who did that got boiled in oil by Herod. There were the most distinctive one, I think we ought to look at, what's called the Fourth Philosophy by the Jewish historian Josephus. And Josephus says they sort of believe all the same things the Pharisees do, except that they have a real passion for freedom, a real passion for independence. And when the Romans imposed the governors and imposed direct Roman rule and the tribute to Caesar, the Fourth Philosophy, a scribe named Judas and a Pharisee named Zadok, pulled other intellectuals together and started a tax resistance, started a resistance to the tribute. And the high priest tried to persuade them to give up their resistance. They persisted for a while. Eventually they gave it up. But their point is this: if we have God as our true Lord and Master, we can't pay the tribute. See the economic implications. If we have God as a Lord and Master, we can't pay the tribute to Rome, because doing that suggests that we're serving Caesar as Lord. But can I throw that term serving in instead of worship? Serving. Serving with your produce, what you raise in your farm, a certain percentage of that would go to Caesar. But Judeans would say, no, 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 it can go at best to the temple. and the traditional covenantal rules would be that is welfare for the poor, and it's tithes that are distributed among the poor. Finally, other popular resistance, and let's just talk about three things here. One is there would be popular protests every so often in Jerusalem, like urban mob would protest against a high priest that Herod would appoint, or would protest at what a Roman governor was doing. I think that's much less important for understanding Jesus than two other things. And one was a whole set of, I've called them popular messianic movements. These are peasant movements led by a peasant who the rest would sort of acclaim as their king, as their popular king. And some of these managed to successfully run their own affairs in the hill country, in one case in Judea, for 3-4 years before the Romans could come in and really suppress them. Now, point here is that there are other leaders and movements around Galilee, Judea, and so forth, led by a king of the Judeans, an Israelite king, king of the Galileans, and so forth. One of them right around the area of Nazareth. Secondly, second type of movement, popular prophetic movements. And these were movements led by a figure who sort of posed like a new Moses or like a new Joshua and is going to lead a new Exodus or a new entry into the Promised Land. They were largely nonviolent. The messianic movements were more like armed rebellions. The popular movements were nonviolent and a little bit, we would say, fantastic in their thinking. The prophet claimed that he was going to hold up the rod and the waters of the Jordan were going to divide and the people could cross over into the Promised Land again. Or another prophet claimed that at his command, God would topple the walls of Jerusalem, the Romans would disappear, and the people would again have their independence. These are right around the time of Jesus. So when Jesus is portrayed in the Gospels as a prophet or a popular king, the script is already there. The script is already there. Jesus is not an isolated figure. He fits in a pattern of one or both of these movements. And that helps us historically to understand then how Jesus would have a role to play and his followers would have a script to follow and see that here was the guy that they were looking for. These things don't just sort of fall out of the sky in the way Israel thinks, the way the Bible thinks. Things work in very human ways and, as you can see, in very economic, political, as well as religious ways. Okay, finally, let's go to Jesus. And here I want to just concentrate on three things, not exactly three incidents, but three things. Jesus as a prophet pronouncing God's condemnation of the imperial order. Jesus as an exorcist of all things, as an exorcist who is exorcising the demons of the imperial invasion and the imperial order. And then thirdly, Jesus as a renewer of the covenant. So that there is a new society happening here. There's a movement, there's also a new order happening here. And let's just go through these step by step. As you can see, this is a bit different approach from what you get from the liberals like the Jesus Seminar and John Dominic Crossan and so forth. Also a bit of a different approach from what you get from the more conservatives like E.P. Sanders or Tom Wright. These are all good friends, but we have our disagreements in approach and very often in the outcome and what we see. First of all, the condemnation. I think I should take a step here preparatory to focusing on these, come to think of it, as to how I'm using the sources. If you're like me, you grew up with a King James Bible where every sentence was a separate verse, chapter and verse. And the way we learned to read was by separate verses. Or if you're in a more liturgical tradition, and I guess mainline churches these days have gotten a lectionary, come to church, you hear read a scripture, but you hear a paragraph. You hear a paragraph, and the next Sunday you hear another paragraph. With the way the UCC's Methodists, whatever, have done it now, you may go through the Gospel of Mark, but you're getting a paragraph once a week for a whole year. Now, you read stories that way? I don't think we read stories that way. And over against the liberals who just focus on Jesus' sayings, and figure out which sayings are authentic and which aren't. Do you know anybody who communicates in one-liners? I don't. I don't think there's serious communication goes on in one-liners. So I think that's all, we've been up some dead-end streets here in this field, and we need to rethink. And one of the ways we started rethinking was some colleagues started reading the Gospel of Mark and other Gospels as literature. Read the story whole. It's a whole story. It has a plot. It has subplots. And in this plot and subplots, there's conflicts. All sorts of conflicts. Interwoven conflicts. Not only can we learn to read them that way, then we can go back into historical context and read these stories as stories in a historical context. And then, interestingly enough, the stories start to fit the context that we know from other sources. Have you heard of the concept historical verisimilitude? This, we're not being literalists now. We're not taking the story as if it's a true story, you know, just the way it came from, you know, from God through Mark or something. No, we're reading it as a story that is true to the situation that we know from other sources. Now, let's just think a little bit about the Gospel of Mark. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but let's just go through it ever so briefly. Jesus starts out in Galilee declaring the kingdom of God is at hand. Political statement. If it's kingdom of God is at hand, that means there's no place for the kingdom of Caesar, the kingdom of Herod. And immediately he calls disciples, and pretty soon there are 12. Symbolic number? 12 tribes of Israel, okay. Commissions them to go on mission. And to carry out part of his mission. Then he starts doing healings and exorcisms. Much of the Gospel of Mark is healings and exorcisms. What are healings and exorcisms all about? Come back around to that when we get to exorcism. And meanwhile, the disciples begin to misunderstand and just really misread Jesus, misunderstand what it's all about. And then Jesus, meanwhile, is doing things like giving instruction, often in dialogue form. And the instruction, especially in chapter 10 of the Gospel of Mark, looks awfully much like traditional covenantal teaching. Awfully much like traditional covenantal teaching. All this time, he's in Galilee, which is way up north. It's kind of the sticks. And then he's across the border, across the frontier every so often, to the villages of other territories. Of other territories. This may be important for implications of the broader scope of the movement. And finally, just past the middle, he marches up to Jerusalem. Now, why would a Galilean march up to Jerusalem, especially considering that during his lifetime, there was another Herod who was the ruler of Galilee, and Jerusalem didn't even have political jurisdiction? Well, he's going up there for some reason. I want to suggest he's going up there because that's then historically the center of Israel, the capital of Israel. And when he goes up there, he walks right into to the temple and he lambastes it. We're going to come back to this in just a minute. And it continues for episode after episode after episode where he's engaging in direct confrontation of the high priest in the temple and condemnation. And at the end of that, he declares that the temple is about to be destroyed. And by then, the high priests know they have to get him. Earlier, I left this out. Earlier, the Pharisees and the Herodians were trying to figure out how they could destroy him. And we've got that subplot going on. And finally, the high priests figure they've got to get a hold of him. They do by the betrayal and then try him. The accusation is claiming he's going to destroy the temple, turn him over to the Roman governor, and the Roman governor executes him as a political rebel. That's the story. We should add the open ending, by the way. The women are there at the empty tomb, yeah, and they're told that he's going ahead of them to Galilee, and then they're scared and they go away, and that's the end of the story. Open end of the story, obviously continuing up in Galilee, back up in Galilee. Now, the main plot is not discipleship and the failure of the disciples and so forth. The main plot is Jesus is doing a renewal of Israel, 12, New Covenant teaching, and the new renewal of Israel over against in condemnation of the rulers of Israel, who, as we already see, are the subset of the imperial order. And in the course of things, Jesus makes a direct confrontation with the Romans, which we'll come to next. Okay, got the overall plot? Same plot in Matthew, same plot in Luke, somewhat the same plot in John. And then in the material that Matthew and Luke have of the teaching of Jesus, It's no longer a plot, but the teaching is somewhat the same thing. It's condemnation of the rulers and then teaching about a renewal of the covenant. By the way, you you Congregationalists and UCCs have always had this right over against the Methodists and the Episcopals and so forth, who didn't get that there's this much covenant going on in these gospel material. Okay, now to Jesus in three steps. Condemnation of the rulers. That demonstration in the temple picks up on Jeremiah's preaching against the temple, that because the temple, the whole order, has been violating the covenant, violating the Mosaic covenant, it stands under God's condemnation. This is, in pure, simple terms, a violent demonstration. Not armed, but he's blocking the usual business. If students walked into the dean's office and blocked the usual business, it would be considered obstruction, and they would be arrested. That's what Jesus is doing. He's blocking the usual business, and he's declaring that the temple has become a bandit's lair, a bandit's hideaway. Who are the bandits? The high priests, who are robbing the people and then fleeing to their temple and pretending that they have the protection of religion, protection of established religion, so they're not vulnerable. Jesus is saying, yes, you are. You stand under God's condemnation. The parable of the tenants. And in the Gospel of Mark, it's clear from what the way the high priests respond, oh, he told that parable against us, that they were the tenants who had not taken care of the vineyard very well and therefore stood under God's condemnation. It continues with the lambasting of the scribes who devour widows' houses. Next little episode, here comes a timid little widow who gives the last of her living to the temple. Next episode, he says this temple's about to be destroyed. You follow the sequence? Follow the sequence in the narrative? See, we don't get that. We preach that one on Pledge Sunday, right? Right. But it has the opposite implication. Woe to the scribes who devour widows' houses. Here comes a widow who gives her last bit of her living that she had to live on to the temple. And then comes the episode that the temple is going about to be destroyed. And then Jesus is on trial by the Jewish council, by the Jerusalem council. Let me, I slipped there. Did you hear my slip? I said Jewish? I didn't mean to say that, but I too slipped back into it. By the high priestly council, right? By the Judean ruler's council, is accused of threatening to destroy the temple. Well, that's exactly what he was doing in all of those episodes, is declaring it stands under God's condemnation. Related to this, where do the Romans fit? In those confrontations, one of the episodes is the Pharisees and Herodians come to Jesus with a trick question. They're going to entrap him so that they can arrest him. Tell us, great teacher, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar or not? Is it lawful? No. They know it. But of course, we know it's not lawful, but we better do it or we're dead meat. Yeah? And those are the people mediating the Roman imperial order saying that. And notice Jesus' answer. And here, can we get out of our heads the church-state split, the religion-politics split? Get that out of our heads. Jesus' answer is, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. What things belong to Caesar?
To God, what is God?
And give to God the things that are God's. That's the phrase in Greek. The things that are Caesar's. What things are Caesar's? Coins, maybe. Yeah, that's right. There's a coin in the story. That would be Caesar's. Sure, give that back. But otherwise, nothing is God. Nothing is Caesar's. And what is God's?
Everything.
So Jesus is here declaring that we Israelites owe nothing to Caesar. That's illegitimate. We don't. Now, whether or not Jesus was saying don't render up the tribute, it's not clear. But he's saying, in principle at least, we don't owe it. Okay, now let's go to the exorcism. Remember the name of the demon Jesus casts out in the second or the third story?
Legion.
And in your Bibles, how's that translated? Multiple, many. That's always the way we read it. Oh yeah, it means many. And that's right, it does mean many. But in the Roman imperial context, what's it mean? A legion was a division of troops. Right? Okay, can I use a little comparative material here? I never really looked for this before, but recently was asked to do a paper on Jesus, Africa, and healing. So I started reading something about what's going on in Africa in exorcism cults and exorcism meetings. And come to find out that people subjected to, in this case, some of the Africans would be to Arab officials, and then subjected to the British colonial rule, the names of the demons would be the names of Arabic officials, or the names of British officials, or particular British generals. Lord Cromer was the name of one of the demons. Cromer was the general who came down through Egypt into East Africa. Isn't that interesting? The names of the demons would be the people who have power over the people. And one distinctive one was Kaijesu. You get it? Jesus. Mission. Christian missions are coming in and tremendous power over the people. And here's an interesting one, because the alternative to converting would be to be possessed by Kaijesu. Isn't that interesting? Okay, go back to Palestine. At the time of Jesus, we're realizing that in Judean apocalyptic literature, at least, there's a sudden upsurge of belief in spirits, of belief in heavenly spirits, good and bad, angels and demons. And in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's systematized. There's the Prince of Light and the Prince of Darkness. And these are battling it out for history right now. Where you are, it depends on whether you are controlled by the one or the other. Well, what the intellectuals did in the Dead Sea Scrolls, ordinary people were doing, but less systematically. So they would be possessed by demons, and here comes Jesus, meets this demon, meets this demoniac, this possessed man, who is so violent to himself and to others that they have chained him. Chained him in the cemetery. Isn't that interesting? Chained him in the cemetery. And still, he's uncontrollable. I'm even wanting to use a little sort of family therapy, family psychology on this one. That fellow is acting out for the whole people, for the whole subject community there. Jesus does the exorcism, come out, and then is able to identify the demon. What's your name? Legion. Mm-hmm. And then remember how the story goes? The Legion asks to be cast into the pigs. And the pigs, it's military terminology. They charge headlong, the company of pigs charge headlong into the sea. And the word used for sea is what is the Mediterranean, not the Galilee, right? The big sea, the big ocean, not the lake. Isn't that interesting? Legion, Roman troops, charge, the company charge into the sea and self-destruct. Isn't that interesting? You get it? Jesus is saying here that in the exorcisms, what's being exorcised is Roman imperial power, and the legions are charging back into the sea. And by the way, also notice that the neighbors want to get Jesus out of town fast. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's hard to face the political reality that is masked by the demon possession. How can the Jesus movement, how can these people face that political reality? Third step. They can face it because what Jesus is doing, village by village by village, as he sends those representatives two by two into the villages, and then he does this himself, he's preaching and healing in those villages. And what he's preaching, I suggest, is a covenant renewal. And here we can see this best, I think, in what we know as the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain in Luke, behind which is earlier teaching material that has been developed by Matthew and by Luke separately. And let's now look at the structure of this. As long as we read this verse by verse, we don't get it. Love your enemies. Turn the other cheek. Let me ask you to think about this. What is the context indicated in the content of the sayings? You might not get, if somebody wants to take your outer garment, give them your underwear too. By the way, that's funny. Right? Somebody wants to take your cloak, give them your underwear too. You'd be standing stark naked in that case. But what about turn the cheek? Turn the other cheek. What's the context, the social context, indicated in the content of the sayings? Is it the Romans? Isn't it local interaction? Isn't it local insult and interaction? That whole set of sayings pertains to local affairs. Now, what I want to do is back off and look at the overall structure. It starts out with, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall... Blessed are those who hunger, for they shall be satisfied." It's, "Blessed are the poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." That's the first step. Then you get love your enemies, do good, and lend. If someone wants to take your outer garment, give your undergarment, and so forth. Let's pause on that one just a minute. You remember what that where that comes from in covenantal teaching. You're not supposed to charge interest. And someone is going to borrow from you, and you're making the loan. Then you take the person's garment as a symbolic pledge, symbolic collateral. But, says the covenant rule, you have to give it back before sundown because that's their covering for the night. In a poor society, they just have a cloak, which is also the covering for the night. So you have to give it back before nightfall. What this is talking about is lending and borrowing on the local level. When people are under pressure to pay three levels of taxation, they're lending and borrowing, they're becoming desperate. But they're trying to help each other, but pretty soon that turns them against each other. Judge not that you be not judged. All those sayings fit a local context. And, by the way, every one of them allude to earlier covenant teaching that you can find in the book of Exodus, the book of Leviticus. This is covenantal teaching. Step two, the end of the speech is the double parable of building your house on the rock and building your house on the sand. Now, let's go back to that covenant structure. It started out with a declaration of deliverance from Egypt. It proceeded with the covenant principles. Finally, there were the blessings and curses to make everybody do it. Jesus is starting with the blessings and curses. What's he doing? He's giving a new declaration of deliverance. The God is giving you the kingdom. Now, on that basis, let's renew the covenantal practices here. Basically, he's saying, take care of each other. Share, despite the circumstances. Take care of each other. No more quarreling locally here. We know it's tough, but get it together locally. And then the house built on the sand and the house built on the rock are the sanctions, are the motivations. Life will go well for you if you do the covenant teachings, and it won't go well if you don't have that solid foundation. Now, I'm suggesting that what much of Jesus' teaching is about is this covenant renewal. Now, let's give one more example. Familiar, our Father, the Heavenly One, give us the kingdom, and give us bread. We need something to eat. And cancel our debts, even as we herewith cancel the debts of our debtors. Got that one? The Presbyterians got that one right? It's debtors, debts, debtors, not sins and forgiveness. There would be many other examples we could give, but what Jesus is doing here is covenant renewal, and if people are doing that covenant renewal, then those communities can manage to resist the Roman imperial order and hang on. I'm not suggesting that Jesus is leading a movement of direct resistance, but I think it's a movement where they're trying to live out the covenantal order again in renewed form over again the imperial order, which stands under God's condemnation. Now, final step I want to take. Let's bring it back to us. The United States was God's new Israel in the settlement in the Eastern Seaboard, and then in the Revolutionary War and the Constitution. It was God's new Israel. This is a very strong theme in American culture, American history. The United States also, however, understood itself from early on as the new Rome. As the new Rome. This was already the case with Jefferson, Republican virtue and so forth, and Jefferson who brought us the Louisiana Purchase, stretching now all the way to the Pacific. In the Mexican-American War, the United States just moved to take over half of Mexico, was it? And the Eastern press and so forth was all in favor of that, all in favor of that. The senators, so forth, not just President Polk. The westward expansion was understood as, I wish I could blow this up. Anybody interested, come and look at this book, Manifest Destiny, which is where I'm getting much of this. Excellent book written for college courses. And here's the Star of Liberty, the star of mission of empire, striding across the continent. And there's illumination in the east where it's coming from and darkness in the west. It's a civilizing mission that sprang indeed from America being God's new Israel, but then was especially important as the new Rome. This reached its climax, perhaps, under Teddy Roosevelt. Just before that with the Spanish-American War, where finally the U.S. started behaving like an imperial power. And, of course, Roosevelt thought that in order to bring the blessings of civilization, the extension of law and civilization to other peoples, that might just require a little brutality. So invasion of other peoples and so forth was part of the picture. Now, what was striking to me upon doing a new review of American history. I didn't get this in our high school courses, our high school history courses. I didn't get this in American intellectual history with Arthur Schlesinger. I didn't get this in American social history with Oscar Hanlon and so forth. But until the 20th century, this was discussed explicitly as in imperial terms, as building an American empire. America was the latest in the westward movement of empire. I think this is just deeply, deeply, deeply rooted in American culture. And so it's not just George W. It's not just George W. George W. is just doing what Teddy Roosevelt was advocating as well as doing. As we then go back and then rethink Jesus standing against empire, as we, some of us being in churches, reading this as the scripture, right, look at this, it's very difficult to understand how the God of that guy would be blessing America, which is, you know, as the new Rome is again in a position of being the beneficiary of the bread and circus that is derived from the tribute and is carrying out an imperial order of controlling as much of the rest of the world as we can. Well, that's my pitch.